All right. So joining us now, we have Josh Frank, who is the founder of The Tie. Josh, how are you doing today?
Yeah, not too bad.
Not too bad at all. Love to hear it. So for many of our listeners have heard of The Tie before and how we have our partnership together with Altcoin Alert and everything. But for those that haven't heard of The Tie, can you give us a high-level overview of what The Tie is and what you guys are doing?
Yeah, so at its core, we solve one major problem for hedge funds, market makers, OTC desks, asset managers, banks, really anyone in the institutional space, which is if you go to a large institution and you ask them, "How are you staying on top of crypto from an information perspective?" What they'll do is they'll show you their browser, and they have 40 or 50 different tabs open in their window. And what we really do for our institutional clients is consolidate the entire market into a single screen. So we bring together news, on-chain data, sentiment data, market data, derivatives data, research, NFT, governance, developer data, you name it. And we exclusively service the world's most sophisticated institutional investors. So our average client could be a $1 trillion asset manager, a tier one bank, a $40 billion hedge fund, as well as some of the larger crypto native institutions. But really, you can think of us as their kind of platform of choice for looking at the market to identify opportunities and better manage risk within the space.
So going back to you or coming to you personally, how did you get involved in the Web3 space and the crypto industry in general, and why the focus here rather than anywhere else?
Yeah, I mean, I was, the transparent answer is I was working at a very boring job. I was working in post-trade settlement technology, and was just really bored. And so I started day trading crypto, and I was actually building quantitative models on equities to try to figure out why equities are moving. And looking at crypto, I was like, why is this market moving? I mean, this was 2016, 17. This is when John McAfee was pushing out a tweet and the price of an asset was going up by 200%. So it's a very different time. And this is when Kodak decided to roll out a blockchain miner, and Long Island Iced Tea rebranded as Long Island Blockchain and all that kind of nonsense, maybe a little bit even before that. And I just couldn't figure out why the asset class was moving. And so that was really the impetus for starting the company. It was to try to figure out what was going on in the market and to try to make sense of it, because I personally wanted to trade crypto and I had no good data or information. I couldn't figure out what was going on. So it was kind of a combination of boredom and a curiosity to figure out what's driving prices of this asset class. And while the output of that has changed over time, I've been in business for over 5 years now, we've grown from the company was just me to we're now 80 plus people. The kind of thesis or the idea behind really making sense of this chaotic market has always been there.
Sure. So given that you and your team have so much data to parse through and everything, but you also are able to draw a ton of actionable insights from that data. And so with that in mind, what are the trends that you're seeing right now? What are we looking at in today's market? What's hot, and where's the focus for institutional investors especially?
Yeah, look, I think the thing about crypto is it what's hot depends on the minute, or the hour, right? It's a very, very fast market. It's a very narrative-driven market, right? You can't just focus on one thing for too long, because if you do, you kind of get left behind, right? We've had now the big thing is RWAs, but RWAs are security tokens that's been around for 6 or 7 years in crypto. It's the same thing. It's just a narrative that's kind of coming back, right? DeFi was a really big narrative before NFTs. Metaverse was the hottest thing when Facebook rebranded as Meta was a giant thing. Now AI tokens all of a sudden are a giant thing because of OpenAI. Seemingly every day, there's kind of a new trend that goes in the market. I think my question is, which of those trends actually become sustainable and become long-term, and have real-world usage? I mean, I think the two biggest trends right now that I'm seeing in the market, at least in terms of conversation, from an institutional perspective, it's definitely RWAs, the idea of taking real-world assets, which I think is a really dumb word, and bringing them on chain. Like tokenizing securities is all it is, right? Taking treasuries and putting them on chain or equities. And we're starting to see that, right? We saw obviously Polygon's partnership with Hamilton Lane, Avalanche's partnership with KKR. We're starting to see a lot more of that, a lot more talks around tokenization of assets. This is a conversation we've been having for 6 or 7 years within the crypto space. It seems to me that we're finally starting to get a little bit of traction. We'll see how sustainable that traction is. But yeah, I mean, that seems to be where, at least on the asset management side, we're starting, and maybe on the bank side, we're starting to kind of see a movement. Yeah, I mean, in terms of institutional adoption trends broadly, you know, there is no slow into, you know, there's not a real significant slowdown of institutional adoption of crypto. I think there's been a lot of talk and thought that post FTX's collapse, post Alameda, post Three Arrows, post, you know, Celsius, post Luna, post all this stupidity, I just keep going, BlockFi, I'm sure we can just, Voyager, we can just keep going and naming these different things, it's taking a second to come to me, right? That institutions would be scared off from the market. And I think the good thing and the good sign is we haven't seen a huge slowdown from an institutional adoption perspective. People are still really interested in this asset class just because they're interested in the fact that like it is relatively immature, which means that there's a lot of opportunities to make money, right? Like, you know, the equity market kind of has perfect information, or not perfect information, but, you know, people can access, you know, pretty much the same information on equities, their PE ratios, their earnings, their revenue, their quarterly calls, all those different metrics. Whereas in crypto, information is a bit more sparse and there's a lot more opportunity to make money. So, you know, I guess trends I'm seeing is continued institutional adoption. Basically, what I like to say is if the institutions were already coming into the space, they haven't stopped. But if they were kind of like on the sideline thinking about it, they have. So I think we're going to continue to see institutions coming in. I think tokenization is a trend that I'm starting to see. But again, as I mentioned earlier, pay attention because next week it might not be a trend anymore. But I guess that's kind of, you know, my high level.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a great point. It is an extremely fast moving industry and, you know, for better or worse sometimes. But you mentioned all of the downside catalysts that we've had in the last year or so. And I wonder, you know, if that hasn't scared away institutional investors, speaking to your clients, what are the primary concerns for those parties?
Well, it certainly scared them. It doesn't mean it stopped them. So those are two different things. So, you know, we've talked to a lot of large funds and like one of the biggest concerns is, you know, hearing this from a fund that's ready to go in crypto, very large fund, 10 to 50 billion AUM, like significant size fund. And, you know, the feedback that we're getting is like, we don't know how to manage risk. How do we get notified when all of these major negative events happen so that we can be ready to be prepared for them? How does our mid-back office team know about all of these negative things? And so I think there's a few different things. I think the first one is we need to be able to respond to a major problem in this asset class, right? We're not scared of there being a major problem as long as we can get notified fast enough and deal with it. But if we can't get a notification of the problem, that's a huge risk. The second is, who is my counterparty? Who am I trading with? Who am I lending and borrowing with, right? And that becomes a huge question as well. Like with Genesis blowing up and BlockFi blowing up, you know, there's been a huge problem with Voyager, been a huge problem with lending in the space in OTC. And so a huge part that I'm hearing from more of the traditional institutional landscape is, who can I trust to do business with? Like, where can I onboard? Which exchanges can I use? I trusted FTX. I invested in FTX. I mean, BlackRock, you know, all these different, I don't know, maybe not. Yeah, I think BlackRock invests in FTX and like Apollo and all these large, I mean, I don't know what the whole list is. You can Google FTX investors. There's hundreds of them, right? All of these large traditional institutions, Sequoia, invest in FTX, right? The question is, who can I trust, right? Where can I put my money? And one of the pieces of feedback I've heard, which is quite interesting, is I don't want to do business with somebody whose primary business is crypto, which is kind of leading to this, I think, you know, this adoption of more TradFi market participants and using them. So for example, BNY Mellon is by far the world's largest custodian. They've rolled out crypto custody. That's a name you can trust. BNY Mellon custodies $20 trillion. I'm serious, $20 trillion of the world's assets, right? And so if you think about, who are you going to trust with your money? Is it a crypto custodian, which has $20 million on their balance sheet and probably needs to raise a Series C or a Series D? Or is it BNY Mellon, who in the case of them getting hacked by $1 billion, feel like, all right, fine, we have to backfill the $1 billion off our personal balance sheet, right? So I think we're going to see like, you know, an adoption of folks like Cowen that are moving into offer more prime services for crypto, State Street and others that, you know, have businesses that aren't primarily crypto. Are the counterparties that I think more of these traditional institutions are more comfortable doing business with. And I think rightfully so. I think as an industry in crypto, we haven't proven that we're ready to deal with these institutions that take on their money. So the first part is I need to know about risk. The second thing is I need to know who I'm dealing with. And the third thing is I need to know what the hell is going on from a regulatory point of view, right? And I think everything that Gary Gensler has been doing is not helping, right? And kind of this lack of regulatory clarity where businesses don't even know what they can do. Firms that want to trade don't even know what they can trade, where they can trade, what exchanges or venues they can trade over, right? And then the fourth thing is just building better tools. Like one of the biggest examples that still kind of is a problem is the prime brokerage space in crypto. Like ideally as an institution, right? If I want to buy $100 million worth of Aptos or $100 million worth of Avalanche or Polygon or whatever, any asset, doesn't matter. I'm not suggesting a particular asset, right? Right now, you kind of need to physically have assets deployed on an exchange where you can buy those assets, right? So for example, imagine that Polygon wasn't available on exchange A, but exchange A is where you had all your money, right? So theoretically, you want to be able to get your money from exchange B onto exchange A to buy that asset, right? And so the idea of prime brokerage and being able to basically have a single point where, you know, basically doesn't matter where your capital is actually deployed, right? You can basically buy any asset that you need. You can hold your assets off of exchange. So you're not worried about, you know, the FTX scenario where they were actually siphoning your money out and trading with it, right? All of these different, you know, these, you know, we can go into prime brokers a lot more, right? But all of these different ideas of, you know, knowing about risks, knowing who your counterparties are, knowing what's going on from a regulatory point of view, being able to actually trade, you know, and manage your capital efficiently, right? All of those things are barriers, I think, to adoption, you know, equally so. And it's not stopping everybody, but it's certainly like putting up, you know, in some cases, 6 or 12 month or 18 month blockers in the schedules of some of these firms, you know, coming into crypto.
Yeah, you know, that's an incredible insight. And there's a lot to unpack there. And you sort of answered a handful of the questions that I had lined up for you already. And so I do want to switch gears a little bit towards the user side. And you were talking about the barriers to adoption for institutional investors. And I was wondering, are there any obvious barriers to adoption for retail investors that you've noticed?
Yeah, 100%. You know, I think there's a few of them. Adoption, the word adoption is also a broad word, because what do you mean by adoption? Do you mean trading the asset or do you mean actually interacting with the asset on chain? Right. And so, you know, I think one big barrier to adoption is regulation. Right. As a New York State resident, like I am, I can't interact with almost any venue. I can interact with Coinbase and Gemini and a couple others, but I'm pretty limited. The same thing goes with my company, actually. We want to be able to interact with crypto a little bit just to receive payment and different things like that, even in stables. Right. And then I go to onboard with an exchange and they're like, well, actually, you're a New York based entity, so we can't do business with you. Right. And so I think regulation is certainly a barrier. I think the SEC shutting down staking for retail investors on Kraken is asinine. It doesn't make any sense. And that's a huge barrier. And I think the other barrier to adoption, which isn't kind of the trading and speculative part of it, but it's more the actual usage of it, is just the fact that we haven't built anything on chain that's that great yet. Like, I think stablecoins are great and they're a fantastic use case for foreign remittances. I think stablecoins are a great use case. Like, if you're in a developing country, which has very high annual inflation rate, right, you want to have a stablecoin because you want basically a US dollar equivalent. I think that's awesome. And I think actually the US government should be really excited about the fact that if we can get crypto denominated in US dollars, that's really great for US dollar dominance. So I don't know why the US government isn't really like a fan. The US government should love stablecoins because it's basically creating even more US dollar dominance. But, you know, there obviously have been a barrier in some ways as well. But I think that the fact of the matter is there's nothing that exciting on chain. Like, the games that are on chain, they're not better than the games that are off chain. I'm going to play Call of Duty and all these other games. I'm not going to play, you know, these random, you know, little mobile games on chain, right? So I think it's, you know, obviously GameFi is just an example of it, right? But the question is, what do I actually need in my life? Right? What do I need to operate, or what am I excited about using? And the fact of the matter is, there's just not that many exciting things on chain yet, right? Like, play to earn isn't really that exciting because at some point people realize it's just incredibly inflationary and the value of the assets is zero, right? So the question is, like, what becomes that thing? I think DeFi has started to become that thing a little bit, right? Where there's this idea of being unbanked and stuff like that. But like, DeFi yields are worse than treasuries now, right? And if DeFi yields are worse than treasuries, why would you want to interact with DeFi? right? And so I think we still need that compelling use case narrative. And I think we need to have an easier experience for the user to onboard. Like, I think ideally, the user doesn't even know that they're interacting on chain when they're interacting on chain, right? Like, you don't really know that you're using AWS. You don't know that I'm on X Spotify's website. I don't know, maybe Spotify uses AWS. Let's say they do. I don't need to know that I'm interacting with AWS on the back end. It's Spotify, right? So I think we just need to make it, you know, like on-chain experiences, you shouldn't need to know that your app operating on-chain for crypto to get mass adoption.
Yeah. And that's I think that's a sentiment that's shared by a lot of founders and developers at the moment is that the user interface really is maybe the biggest drag on adoption. But I want to touch on a point that you brought up in the way that we don't have a real like killer app, so to say, as the term they use in the Web 2 space, I suppose. And so I wonder what in your opinion would be that killer app that we might see in 2 to 3, maybe 5 years?
If I knew, I would be investing in it. Unfortunately, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know if I have a good answer. I think stable coins are the killer app. You know, does that mean that value should accrue to crypto? I'm not sure, but I think stable coins are the killer app.
Interesting. Yeah. And I would think that DeFi, like you said, DeFi is sort of moving into that realm of being more functional or more useful in the real world. But like you said, real world assets seems like such a silly word. But that being said, you know, is that something that you see really catching steam, especially given your interaction with institutional clients?
I think it does. It just depends on what regulators say, right? So can you interact with these protocols? If you can, like, I think you need regulatory clarity for DeFi to really take off. Yeah. Can you interact in a pool? Like, what if somebody who deposited LP tokens in Uniswap was the North Korean government or the Iranian government who are sanctioned, and you're interacting with sanctioned, you know, entities by accident, right? So like, I think there's a lot of questions that we need to kind of address before we start to see that real adoption and the idea of like, how can you do it? And, you know, permission word is a little weird, and institutions don't just want to interact with themselves. It's a problem. Like, if you're a hedge fund, you don't want to be trading against other hedge funds. You want to be trading against retail. So, you know, the question is like, you know, how do we get there from a regulatory compliance point of view? Like, I think an example is maybe you just have a KYC'd DeFi experience. Like, maybe you have a world in which you can basically get your wallet KYC'd, and then a company gives you like, hey, this wallet just has a stamp of approval, and then they can interact with anything on chain and we know that they're KYC'd, right? And so just like things like that are, I think, really needed. And I know that's against the ethos of crypto, right? And it's against the ethos of decentralization and blah, 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 blah. But at the end of the day, if we want adoption, we're gonna have to operate within the confines of regulation, or we're just gonna get absolutely demolished by regulators like we are now, right? I mean, we're feeling it, right? If you don't work with regulators, the SEC, I mean, Hester Pierce wrote a great piece called Cracking Down. I don't know if you saw that a couple of days ago. And let me actually pull up this quote from Hester Pierce on how regulators are operating right now. I thought this was fantastic. So this is what she's saying. So Hester Pierce is a commissioner on the SEC, and this is what she's saying about how the SEC is approaching things. Okay. Most concerning, though, is that our solution to a registration violation is to shut down entirely a program that has served people well. The program will no longer be available in the United States, and Kraken is enjoined from ever offering a staking service in the United States, registered or not. A paternalistic and lazy regulator settles on a solution like this one in the settlement. Do not initiate a public process to develop a workable registration process that provides valuable information to investors. Just shut it down. I mean, Hester is literally shitting on the SEC, and she's an SEC commissioner, right? And so, like, look, in a world where Gary Gensler can just be like, just going to shut it down and, you know, screw you, right? Like, we need to figure out how we can work with regulators and build relationships, because all these Gary memes on Twitter, as much as I want to share them and shit on Gary, it's not helping. I think that just fuels him more to hate the industry.
Yeah, man, what an interesting inflection point in the industry as a whole, and I think you're right. That really is one of the biggest problems that we're facing today. So really appreciate your perspective on all this, and especially your insights to the world of institutional capital. And you know, appreciate your time joining us today. So before we go, is there anything you want to leave our listeners with in terms of where they can find out more information about the tie or follow you or any of your teammates on Twitter?
Yeah, you can follow us. You can follow the tie on Twitter. It's at the tie.io. We share a lot of great stuff. You can sign up for our newsletter. It's totally free. You can read some research that we provide. I also have a podcast called the Fundamental Value Podcast, which is great. It has no advertisers, nothing. It's just free. There's no agenda. Don't even advertise my own business on it. But I bring on generally the top institutional investors in crypto. So my last few episodes, I brought on the head of growth investing at Dragonfly, which is one of the biggest venture funds in crypto. I just brought on Mo, who's the founder of Aptos. It's called Aptos, not Aptos, which I learned by having him on the podcast. I recommend that. You know, we dive a little bit deep. It might be a little bit complicated for the average listener, but the reason I host it is because I get to ask questions to people. And I really recommend listening to it. So that's the only thing I'm going to pump, but not pumping for you to buy anything. Just, you know, get some free content from us.
Love it. Appreciate that. And thanks again for joining us. And we hope to bring you back on the next one as always.
All right. Thanks for having me on.
Save big this holiday season. All in the Kroger app. Buy two, get three free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up. Then get a flavorful Kroger spiral sliced ham for 89 cents a pound with an additional $25 purchase. Limit two, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details. At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.